5. The Rebel Caged. The most valuable blacks are those in prison, those who have the warrior spirit, who had a sense of being African. They got for their women and children what they needed when all other avenues were closed to them. The greatest spirit of resistance among blacks is found among those in prison. August Wilson, Interview with Bill Moyers, October 20, 1988. If I were a member of the class that rules, I would post men in all the neighborhoods of the nation, not to spy upon or club rebellious workers, not to break strikes or disrupt unions, but to ferret out those who no longer respond to the system in which they live. I would make it known that the real danger does not stem from those who seek to grab their share of wealth through force, or from those who seek to defend their property through violence. For both of these groups, by their affirmative acts, support the values of the system in which they live. The millions that I would fear are those who do not dream of the prizes that the nation holds forth, for it is in them, though they may not know it, that a revolution has taken place and is biding its time to translate itself into a new and strange way of life. Richard Wright, Black Boy. I drove 4 hours one rainy, cold morning to SCI, State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy, in Frankville, Pennsylvania, from my home in Princeton, New Jersey, to see the black revolutionary Mumia Abu-Jamal, America's best-known political prisoner. We met in the reception area for the prisoners and their families. He sat hunched forward on the gray plastic table, his dreadlocks cascading down the sides of his face. The room resembled a high school cafeteria. It had vending machines on the wall by the entrance, which the prisoners were not allowed to operate, plastic chairs, a few tables, and a booth for the corrections officers. Small children, visiting their fathers or brothers, raced around the floor or wailed in their mother's arms. Abu-Jamal, like the other prisoners in the room, was wearing a brown jumpsuit bearing the letters DOC, Department of Corrections. We dove immediately into a discussion about books. He spoke intently about the nature of empire, which he was currently reading voraciously about, and effective forms of resistance to tyranny throughout history. Abu-Jamal was transferred in January 2012 to the general prison population after nearly 30 years in solitary confinement on death row. During those 3 decades, he was barred from physical contact with his wife, his children, and other visitors. He had been sentenced to death in 1982 for the December 9, 1981 killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. His sentence was amended to life without parole. The misconduct of the judge, flagrant irregularities in his trial, and tainted evidence have been criticized by numerous human rights organizations, including Amnesty International. Abu-Jamal, who was a young activist in the Black Panthers and later one of the most important radical journalists in Philadelphia, a city that a few decades earlier produced I.F. Stone, has long been the bête noire of the state. The FBI opened a file on him when he started working with a local chapter of the Black Panthers at the age of 15. He was suspended from his Philadelphia high school when he campaigned to rename the school for Malcolm X and distributed black revolutionary student power literature. Abu-Jamal has published 7 books in prison, including his best-selling Live from Death Row, and he was at work on an 8th. Dick Gregory says in Mumia, Long-Distance Revolutionary, the documentary about Abu-Jamal, that he has single-handedly brought dignity to the whole death row. The late historian Manning Marable is quoted in the film saying, "The voice of black journalism in the struggle for liberation of African-American people has always proved to be decisive throughout black history. When you listen to Mumia Abu-Jamal, you hear the echoes of David Walker, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and the sisters and brothers who kept the faith with struggle, who kept the faith with resistance. The authorities, as they did before he was convicted, have attempted to silence him in prison. Pennsylvania banned all recorded interviews with Abu-Jamal after 1996. In response to protests over the singling out of one inmate in the Pennsylvania correction system, the state banned recorded access to all its inmates. The ban is nicknamed the Mumia Rule, and the state did not stop there. In October 2014, days after Abu Jamal gave a pre-recorded commencement address to graduates of Goddard College, the governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Corbett, signed into law the Revictimization Relief Act. The law permits crime victims and prosecutors to go to court to prevent prisoners from making public statements that cause mental anguish. Governor Corbett was surrounded by police officers, victims' advocates, and Faulkner's widow, Maureen Faulkner, at the signing. He said that Mrs. Faulkner has been taunted by the obscene celebrity that her husband's killer has orchestrated from behind bars. This unrepentant cop killer has tested the limits of decency, while gullible activists and celebrities have continued to feed this killer's ego at the expense of his victims. In November 2014, Abu Jamal and supporters filed a federal lawsuit in an attempt to overturn the law. "I was punished for communicating," Abu Jamal said. Philosopher Cornel West says in the documentary, "The state is very clever in terms of keeping track, especially of the courageous and visionary ones, the ones who are long-distance runners. You can keep track of them, absorb them, dilute them, or outright kill them. You don't have to worry about opposition to them. If you tell them the truth about the operation of our power, this is what happens to you," he goes on. "Like Jesus on the cross, this is what happens to you." I was not permitted a pencil or paper during my 4.5-hour conversation with Abu Jamal. I wrote down his quotes immediately after I left the prison. These restrictions mirror the wider pattern of a society where the poor and the destitute, and especially those who rise up in rebellion, are rendered invisible and voiceless. The breadth of Abu Jamal's reading, which along with his writing and 3,000 radio broadcasts has kept his mind and soul intact, was staggering. His own books are banned in the prison. In conversation, he swung from discussions of the opium wars between 1839 and 1860 to the Black Panthers, to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, to the series of legislative betrayals of the poor and people of color by Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Democratic Party. He quoted Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Huey P. Newton, Assata Shakur, Eric Foner, Gore Vidal, Cornel West, Howard Zinn, James Cone, and Dave Zirin. We talked about Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser, Joseph Sinque, Harriet Tubman, Charles Deland, Denmark Vesey, and Sojourner Truth. He was simultaneously reading Masters of War by Clara Nieto, How the World Works by Noam Chomsky, The Face of Imperialism by Michael Parenti, and Now and Then by Gil Scott-Heron. He wondered what shape the collapse of empire will take, and he despaired of the political unconsciousness among many incoming prisoners, some young enough to be his children. "When I first got out in the yard," he said, "and I heard groups of men talking about how Sarah was going to marry Jim or how Frank had betrayed Susan, I thought, damn, these cats all know each other and their families. That's odd. But after a few minutes, I realized they were talking about soap operas. Television in prison is the great pacifier. They love Basketball Wives because it is TNA with women of color. They know how many cars Jay-Z has. But they don't know their own history. They don't understand how they got here. They don't know what is being done to them. I tell them they have to read, and they say, man, I don't do books. And that is just how the empire wants it. You can't fight power if you don't understand it. And you can't understand it if you don't experience it and then dissect it." Abu Jamal's venom is reserved for liberal politicians such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, whom he excoriates for callously disempowering the poor and the working class on behalf of their corporate patrons, and he has little time for those who support them. It was Clinton that made possible the explosion of the prison industrial complex, he said, speaking of the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill. He looked around the visiting area at the 30-odd prisoners with their families. "Most of these people wouldn't be here if it weren't for Bill Clinton," he said. He and Barack Obama haven't done anything for poor people but lock them up. And if our first African-American president isn't going to halt the growth of the prison industrial complex, no president after him is going to do it. This prison system is here to stay. The poor and the destitute feed it. It is the empire's solution to the economic crisis. Those who are powerless, who have no access to diminishing resources, get locked away. And the prison business is booming. It is one of the few growth industries left. It used to be that towns didn't want prisons. Now these poor rural communities beg for them. You look down the list of the names of the guards and see two or three with the same last names. This is because fathers, brothers, spouses work here together. These small towns don't have anything else. The United States has the highest documented incarceration rate in the world, 743 adults per 100,000. Of the 2.3 million adults incarcerated in federal and state prisons and local jails, nearly 60% are non-white. "He who has not been in jail does not know what the state is," Leo Tolstoy said. The omnibus crime bill, pushed through the Senate with the help of Joe Biden, appropriated $30 billion to expand the nation's prison program, state and local law enforcement, and border patrols over a six-year period. It gave $10.8 billion in federal matching funds to local governments to hire 100,000 new police officers over 5 years. It provided nearly $10 billion for the construction of new federal prisons. It instituted the three strikes proposal that mandates a life sentence for anyone convicted of three violent felonies. The bill permitted children as young as 13 to be tried as adults. It authorized the use of secret evidence. The prison population during the Clinton presidency jumped from 1.4 million to 2 million. Between 1982 and 2001, total state corrections expenditures increased each year, rising from $15 billion to $53.5 billion in real dollars, according to the Department of Justice, DOJ. Between 2002 and 2010, according to the DOJ, expenditures fluctuated annually between $53.4 billion and $48.4 billion. Abu Jamal talked about being a Black Panther and the use of violence as a form of political resistance throughout history. He remembered visiting the Chicago apartment where Black Panther leader Fred Hampton was shot to death by Chicago police and the FBI while he slept on December 4, 1969. He called Hampton, who was 21 when he was killed, one of the bright lights. Abu Jamal choked up, and his eyes glistened with tears. "Fred," he said as his voice trailed off. "It used to be that a politician promised jobs, a chicken in every pot," Abu Jamal went on. "But in our new national security state, they promise law and order. They get elected by saying they will be tough on crime and by calling for the death penalty. Death cells, fear cells. What was a crime by the state in the 1960s is now legal. The state can wiretap, eavesdrop, listen to phone calls, and break into homes, and there is nothing we can do about it. The mass incarceration and the mass repression impact every community to make people afraid and compliant." Abu Jamal has written, "In this place, a dark temple of fear, an altar of political ambition, death is a campaign poster, a stepping stone to public office. In this space and time, in this dark hour, how many of us are not on death row?" "The brutality of the empire was exposed under George W. Bush," he said to me. "The empire desperately needed a new face, a black face, to seduce the public. This is the role of Barack Obama. He is the black face of empire. He was pitched to us during the most recent presidential campaign by Bill Clinton, the same Clinton who gave us NAFTA in 1994 and abolished good-paying manufacturing jobs for millions of workers. The same Clinton who locked us up. Clinton and Obama represent the politics of betrayal at the heart of the corporatist machinery. And they have fooled a lot of people, especially black people. During slavery, And even post-Reconstruction, there were always a few black people who served the system. The role of these black servants to white power was to teach passivity in the face of repression. This is why Obama is president. Nothing has changed. Abu Jamal saw hope in the Occupy movement, largely because white middle-class youths were beginning to experience the cruelty of capitalism and state repression that had long been visited on poor people of color. But, he added, we must recover our past if we are going to effectively resist. We must connect ourselves to the revolutionaries, radicals, and prophets who fought injustice before us. We must defy the historical amnesia that the corporate state seeks to cement into our consciousness. His book, Faith of Our Fathers, An Examination of the Spiritual Life of African and African-American People, sets out to do precisely this: to recover a past intellectual and spiritual life for African Americans that has been trivialized, ignored, or censored by the dominant culture. He was worried that the mindless diversions of popular culture and the assault by corporate power on education are keeping many from grasping not only what is happening, but the continuity between modern systems of oppression and older systems of oppression. We would not be who we are as African Americans of this date were it not for the Reverend, the Prophet Nat Turner, who brilliantly merged the religious with the political, Abu Jamal said in the film, who didn't just talk about the world to come, but fought to transform the world that is. You know, Nat Turner is honored and revered today, not because he could quote the Bible well, he could do that, but because he worked in the fields of life to get the slave master off his neck, off of all of our necks. The vending machines in the reception area dispensed White Castle hamburgers, soda, candy, and tasty cake cupcakes. I dropped in the prepaid tokens, no money is allowed inside the prison, and the fast food tumbled into the vent. For Abu Jamal, forced to eat prison food for decades, it was a treat, especially the Hershey's bar. He watched as a boy darted past him toward his father. I didn't see children for 30 years on death row, he said quietly. It's a delight to see them here. They are what is most precious, what the struggle is finally about. The effort to silence Abu Jamal is part of the cultural drive to crush the remnants of the black prophetic tradition. This tradition, which stretches back to Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, has consistently named and damned the cruelty of imperialism and white supremacy. It has been our most astute critique of empire. The black prophetic tradition expressed radical truths with a clarity and moral force that have eluded most other critics of American capitalism. Obama first displayed his fear of this tradition when he betrayed his pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, abetting the brutal character assassination of one of the nation's most prophetic voices. And Obama has sustained this assault, largely through black surrogates such as the Reverend Al Sharpton, Tom Joyner, and Steve Harvey, in vicious attacks on Cornel West. Jeremiah Wright was the canary in the mine, West told me when we spoke in Princeton, New Jersey, where we both live. The black prophetic tradition has been emptied out. Its leaders have either been murdered or incarcerated. A lot of political prisoners who represent the black prophetic tradition are in jail. They have been in there for decades. Or we have leaders who have completely sold out. They have been co-opted. And these are the three major developments. With sold-out leaders, you get a pacified followership, or people who are scared. The black prophetic tradition has been the leaven in the American democratic loaf, West said. What has kept American democracy from going fascist or authoritarian or autocratic has been the legacy of Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Martin King, Fannie Lou Hamer. This is not because black people have a monopoly on truth, goodness, or beauty. It is because the black freedom movement puts pressure on the American empire in the name of integrity, decency, honesty, and virtue. The tradition is sustained by a handful of beleaguered writers and intellectuals, including Glenn Ford and his Black Agenda Report, James Cone, Carl Dix, Bruce Dixon, Boyce Watkins, Yvette Carnell, Robin Kelly, Margaret Kimberly, Nellie Bailey, the Reverend Michael Flager, Milana Karenga, Ajamu Baraka, and Jeremiah Wright, But none have the public profile of West, who is relentlessly attacked by Obama's black supporters as a race traitor, the equivalent of a self-hating Jew to hardline supporters of Israel. It is understandable why this tradition frightens Obama. It exposes him for what he is, the ideological heir of Booker T. Washington, a black accommodationist whose core message to black people was, in the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, adjustment and submission. Obama's message to the black underclass in the midst of the corporate rape of the nation is drawn verbatim from the Booker T. Washington playbook. He tells them to work harder, as if anyone works harder than the working poor in this country, to get an education and to obey the law. Obama is the highest manifestation of the co-optation that took place, West said. It shifted to the black political class. The black political class, more and more, found itself unable to tell the truth, or if they began to tell some of the truth, they were put under surveillance, attacked, or demonized. 40% of our babies are living in poverty, living without enough food, and Obama comes to us and says, quit whining. He doesn't say that to the business roundtable. He doesn't say that to the corporate elites. He doesn't say that to AIPAC, the conservative Jewish brothers and sisters who will do anything to support the Israeli occupation against Palestinians. This kind of neglect in policy is coupled with disrespect in his speeches to black folk, which the mainstream calls tough love. He is a shell of a man, West said of Obama. There is no deep conviction. There is no connection to something bigger than him. It is a sad spectacle. Sad if he were not the head of an empire that is in such decline and so dangerous. This is a nadir. William Trotter and Du Bois, along with Ida B. Wells Barnett, were going at Booker T. tooth and nail. Look at the fights between Marcus Garvey and Du Bois, or Garvey and A. Philip Randolph. But now, if you criticize Obama the way Randolph criticized Garvey, you become a race traitor and an Uncle Tom. A lot of that comes out of the Obama machine, the Obama plantation. The most pernicious development is the incorporation of the black prophetic tradition into the Obama imperial project, West told me. Obama used Martin Luther King's Bible during his inauguration, but under the National Defense Authorization Act, King would be detained without due process. He would be under surveillance every day because of his association with Nelson Mandela, who was head of a terrorist organization, the African National Congress. We see the richest prophetic tradition in America desecrated in the name of a neoliberal worldview, a worldview King would be in direct opposition to. Martin would be against Obama because of his neglect of the poor and the working class, and because of the aerial drones, because he is a war president, because he draws up kill lists. And Martin King would have nothing to do with that. We are talking about crimes against humanity. Wall Street crimes, war crimes, the crimes of the criminal justice system in the form of Jim Crow, the crimes against our working poor that have their backs pushed against the wall because of stagnant wages and corporate profits going up, West explained. Abraham Heschel said that the distinctive feature of any empire in decline is its indifference to criminality. That is a fundamental feature of our time, an indifference to criminality, especially on top. Wickedness in high places. This is not personal, West said. This was true for George W. Bush. It was true for Bill Clinton. We are talking about an imperial system manifest in Obama's robust effort to bomb Syria in 2013. War crimes against Syrian children do not justify U.S. war crimes. We are talking about a corporate state and a massive surveillance and national security state. It operates according to its own logic, profit on the one hand and secrecy to hide imperial policy on the other. Jesse Jackson was the head house Negro on the Clinton plantation, just as Sharpton is the head house Negro on the Obama plantation. But there is a difference. Jesse was willing to oppose Clinton on a variety of issues. He marched, for example, against the welfare bill. But Sharpton loves the plantation. He will not say a critical word. It is sad and pathetic. We are living in the age of the sellout. Garvey used to say that as long as black people were in America, the masses of black people, the poor, and the working class would never be treated with respect, decency, or fairness, West noted. That has always been a skeleton in the closet, the fundamental challenge to the black prophetic tradition. It may very well be that black people will never be free in America. But I believe, and the black prophetic tradition believes, that we proceed because black people are worthy of being free. Just as poor people of all colors are worthy of being free, even if they never will be free. That is the existential leap of faith. There is no doubt that with a black president, the black masses are still treated unfairly, from stop and frisk to high unemployment, indecent housing, and decrepit education. It is a spiritual issue, West said. What kind of person do you choose to be? People say, well, Brother West, since the mass of black folk will never be free, then let me just get mine. That is the dominant response. I am wasting my time fighting a battle that can't be won. But that is not what the black prophetic tradition is about. History is a mystery. Yes, it doesn't look good. But the masses of black folk must be respected. Malcolm X used to say, as long as they are not respected, you could show me all the individual respect you want. But I know it's empty. That is the fundamental divide between the prophetic tradition and the sellouts. The tradition has been diminished by what West called the emaciation of the black press that once amplified the voices of black radicals. The decline of the black press and the consolidation of the media, especially the electronic media, into the hands of a few corporations has shut out those who have remained faithful to this tradition. West does not appear on MSNBC, where the black and white hosts serve as giddy cheerleaders for Obama, and was abruptly dropped as a scheduled guest on an episode of CBS's Face the Nation that aired after the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Because the black prophetic tradition is rarely taught in schools, including primarily African-American schools, it is at risk of being extinguished. The black prophetic tradition, West observed, no longer has a legitimacy or significant foothold in the minds of the black masses. With corporate media and the narrowing of the imagination of all Americans, including black people, there is an erasure of memory. This is the near death of the black prophetic tradition. It is a grave issue. It is a matter of life and death. It means that the major roadblock to American fascism, which has been the black prophetic tradition, is gone. To imagine America without the black prophetic tradition, from Frederick Douglass to Fannie Lou Hamer, means an American authoritarian regime, American fascism. We already have the infrastructure in place for the police state. Black intelligence and black suspicion is still there among the masses, West said. Black people are not stupid. We are not completely duped. We are just scared. We don't think there is any alternative. This is re-niggerization of the black professional class. They have big money, nice positions, comfort and convenience, but are scared, intimidated, afraid to tell the truth, and will not bear witness to justice. Those who are incorporated into the black professional and political class are willing to tolerate disrespect for the black masses and sip their tea and accept their checks and gain access to power. That is what niggerization is. Keeping people afraid and intimidated. Bonnie Kerness, with a bun of blonde hair, sat behind a desk in her cramped office in Newark, where she runs the American Friends Service Committee's Prison Watch. Mass incarceration, which she called the war at home, is the latest physical mutation of systems of social control to thwart black radicalism and silence the black prophetic tradition. The infrastructure within prisons, she said, is designed to contain and silence black radicals and will be used to contain anyone who decides to resist the corporate state. There are no former Jim Crow systems, Kerness said. The transition from slavery to black codes to convict leasing to the Jim Crow laws to the wars on poverty, veterans, youth, and political activism in the 1960s has been a seamless evolution of political and social incapacitation of poor people of color. The sophisticated fascism of the practices of stop and frisk, charging people in inner cities with wandering, driving and walking while black, zip code racism, these and many other de facto practices all serve to keep our prisons full. In a system where 60% of those who are imprisoned are people of color, where students of color face harsher punishments in school than their white peers, where 58% of African American youth are sent to adult prisons, where women of color are 69% more likely to be imprisoned, and where offenders of color receive longer sentences, the concept of color blindness doesn't exist. The racism around me is palpable. The 1960s, when the last of the Jim Crow laws were reversed, this whole new set of practices accepted by law enforcement was designed to continue to feed the money-generating prison system, which has neo-slavery at its core, she said. Until we deeply recognize that the system's bottom line is social control and creating a business from bodies of color and the poor, nothing can change. She noted that more than half of those in the prison system have never physically harmed another person, but that just about all of these people have been harmed themselves. And not only does the criminal justice system sweep up the poor and people of color, but slavery within the prison system is permitted by the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which reads, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States." This provision, Kerness said, is at the core of how the labor of slaves was transformed into what people in prison call neo-slavery. Neo-slavery is an integral part of the prison industrial complex, in which hundreds of thousands of the nation's prisoners, primarily people of color, are forced to work at involuntary labor for pennies an hour. If you call the New Jersey Bureau of Tourism, you are most likely talking to a prisoner at the Edna Mann Correctional Institution for Women, who is earning 23 cents an hour, who has no ability to negotiate working hours or working conditions, she said. The bodies of poor, unemployed youths are worth little on the streets, but become valuable commodities once they are behind bars. Marie Gottschalk, in Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics, points out, like Alexander, that prisons, or what she calls the carceral state, extends far beyond those trapped inside prison walls. It encompasses the more than 8 million people, or 1 in 23 adults, who are under some form of state control, including jail, prison, probation, parole, community sanctions, drug courts, immigrant detention, and other forms of government supervision, she writes. It includes the millions of people who are booked into jail each year, perhaps nearly 7 million, and the estimated 7.5% of all adults who are felons or ex-felons. Prison affects the lives of millions of people who have never been arrested. There are, Gottschalk points out, an estimated 8 million minors, or 1 in 10 children, who have a parent incarcerated. 2 million children have a mother or father in prison. Millions of Americans have, she writes, been condemned to civil death, stripped of their voting rights, rendered ineligible for student loans, food stamps, and public housing because of criminal convictions. And the explosion of the penal system, accompanied by expanding rural poverty, means that it is no longer a black-white issue or a form solely of racial control. There are mounting incarceration rates for women, the fastest-growing segment of the prison population, poor whites, Latinos, and immigrants. The carceral state, unable to satiate itself with black bodies, is consuming other groups and ethnicities. People have said to me that the criminal justice system doesn't work, Kerness said. I've come to believe exactly the opposite, that it works perfectly, just as slavery did, as a matter of economic and political policy. How is it that a 15-year-old in Newark, who the country labels worthless to the economy, who has no hope of getting a job or affording college, can suddenly generate $20,000 to $30,000 a year once trapped in the criminal justice system? The expansion of prisons, parole, probation, the court, and police systems has resulted in an enormous bureaucracy which has been a boon to everyone from architects to food vendors, all with one thing in common, a paycheck earned by keeping human beings in cages. The criminalization of poverty is a lucrative business, and we have replaced the social safety net with a dragnet. In 1913, Philadelphia's Eastern State Penitentiary discontinued its isolation cages, which had driven prisoners insane. Prisoners within the U.S. prison system would not be held in prolonged isolation again in large numbers until the turmoil of the 1960s. The rise of the anti-war and civil rights movements, along with the emergence of radical groups such as the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, and the American Indian Movement, saw a return to systematized abuse within the prison system. In 1975, Trenton State Prison, now New Jersey State Prison, established a Management Control Unit, or isolation unit, for political prisoners, mostly Black radicals such as Ojori Lutalo, a leader in the Black Liberation Army, whom the state wanted to segregate from the wider prison population. Those held in the isolation unit were rarely there because they had violated prison rules. They were there because of their revolutionary beliefs, beliefs that the prison authorities feared might resonate with other prisoners. In 1983, the federal prison in Marion, Illinois, instituted a permanent lockdown, creating, in essence, a prison-wide control unit. By 1994, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, using the Marion model, had built its maximum security prison in Florence, Colorado. The use of prolonged isolation and sensory deprivation exploded. Special housing units were used for the mentally ill. Security threat group management units were formed for those accused of gang activity. Communication management units were formed to isolate Muslims labeled as terrorists. Voluntary and involuntary protective custody units were formed. Administrative segregation punishment units were formed to isolate prisoners said to be psychologically troubled. All were established in open violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture and the UN's International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Once you disappear behind prison walls, you become prey. Rape, torture, beatings, prolonged isolation, sensory deprivation, racial profiling, chain gangs, forced labor, rancid food, children sentenced and imprisoned as adults, prisoners forced to take medications to induce lethargy, inadequate heating and ventilation, poor health care, draconian sentences for nonviolent crimes, endemic violence. Lutalo endured his prolonged isolation by methodically tearing up the few magazines and newspapers he was allowed to read and making political collages that kept alive his defiance and his dignity, an example of Havel's advice to break the rules of the game to preserve one's identity. "Prisons, America's finest slave plantation," read one. "Blessed are those who struggle. Oppression is worse than the grave. Better to die for a noble cause than to live and die a slave," read another, a quote from The Last Poets. "One of the worst places on earth," read yet another. Lutalo wrote to Bonnie Kerness in 1986 while he was a prisoner at Trenton State Prison. He described to her the bleak and degrading world of solitary confinement, the world of the prisoners like him held in the so-called Management Control Unit, which he called a prison within a prison. Before being released in 2009, Lutalo was in the Management Control Unit for 22 of the 28 years he served for the second of two convictions, the first for a bank robbery and the second for a gun battle with a drug dealer. "He kept his sanity," he told me, "by following a strict regimen of exercising in his tiny cell, writing, meditating, and putting together his collages to portray his prison conditions. The guards in riot gear would suddenly wake you up at 1 a.m., force you to strip, and make you grab all your things and move you to another cell just to harass you," he said when we spoke in Kerness's Newark office. "They had attack dogs with them that were trained to go for your genitals. You spent 24 hours alone one day in your cell and 22 the next. If you do not have a strong sense of purpose, you don't survive psychologically. Isolation is designed to defeat prisoners mentally, and I saw a lot of prisoners defeated." Lutalo's letter was Kerness's first indication that the U.S. prison system was creating something new, special detention facilities that under international law are a form of torture. Lutalo wrote to her, How does one go about articulating desperation to another who is not desperate? How does one go about articulating the psychological stress of knowing that people are waiting for me to self-destruct? The techniques of sensory deprivation and prolonged isolation were pioneered by the Central Intelligence Agency to break prisoners during the Cold War. Alfred McCoy, in A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, writes that interrogators had found that mere physical pain, no matter how extreme, often produced heightened resistance. So, the intelligence agency turned to the more effective mechanisms of sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, McCoy notes in his book. One example of self-inflicted pain is to force a prisoner to stand without moving or to hold some other stressful bodily position for a long period. The combination, government psychologists argued, would cause victims to feel responsible for their own suffering and accelerate psychological disintegration. Sensory disorientation combines extreme sensory overload with extreme sensory deprivation. Prolonged isolation is followed by intense interrogation. Extreme heat is followed by extreme cold. Glaring light is followed by total darkness. Loud and sustained noise is followed by silence. The fusion of these two techniques, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, creates a synergy of physical and psychological trauma whose sum is a hammer blow to the existential platforms of personal identity, McCoy writes. After hearing from Lutalo, Kerness became a fierce advocate for him and other prisoners held in isolation units. She published through her office a survivor's manual for those held in isolation, as well as a booklet titled Torture in United States Prisons, and she began to collect the stories of prisoners held in isolation. My food trays have been sprayed with mace or cleaning agents, human feces and urine put into them by guards who deliver trays to my breakfast, lunch, and dinner, a prisoner in isolation in the Wabash Valley Correctional Facility in Carlisle, Indiana, was quoted as saying in Torture in United States Prisons. I have witnessed sane men of character become self-mutilators, suffer paranoia, panic attacks, hostile fantasies about revenge. One prisoner would swallow packs of AA batteries and stick a pencil in his penis. They would cut on themselves to gain contact with staff nurses or just to draw attention to themselves. These men made slinging human feces body waste daily like it was a recognized sport. Some would eat it or rub it all over themselves as if it was body lotion. Prisoncrats use a form of restraint, a bed crafted to strap men in four-point Velcro straps, both hands to the wrist and both feet to the ankles, and secured. Prisoners have been kept like this for 3 to 6 hours at a time. Most times they would remove all their clothes. The special confinement unit used water hoses on these men also. When prisons become overcrowded, prisoncrats will do forced double bunking. Overcrowding issues present an assortment of problems, many of which results in violence. Prisoncrats will purposely house a sex offender in a cell with prisoners with sole intentions of having him beat up or even killed. Prisons are at once hugely expensive and, as Kerness pointed out, hugely profitable. Prisons function in the same way the military-industrial complex functions. The money is public, and the profits are private. Privatization in the prison industrial complex includes companies which run prisons for profit, while at the same time gleaning profits from forced labor, she said. In the state of New Jersey, food and medical services are provided by corporations, which have a profit motive. One recent explosion of private industry is the partnering of Corrections Corporation of America with the federal government to detain close to 1 million undocumented people. Using public monies to enrich private citizens is the history of capitalism at its most exploitive. Those released from prison are woefully unprepared for reentry. They bear the years of trauma they endured and often suffer from the endemic health problems that come with long incarceration, including hepatitis C, tuberculosis, and HIV. Many of them lack access to medications upon release to treat their physical and mental illnesses. Finding work is difficult, and they feel alienated and are often estranged from friends and family. More than 60% end up back in prison. How do you teach someone to rid themselves of degradation? Kerness asked. How long does it take to teach people to feel safe, a sense of empowerment in a world where they often come home emotionally and physically damaged and unemployable? There are many reasons that ex-prisoners do not make it. Paramount among them is that they are not supposed to succeed. Kerness grew up asking different questions. In 1961, at the age of 19, she left New York to work for a decade in Tennessee in the civil rights struggle, including a year at Tennessee's Highlander Research and Education Center, where Rosa Parks and other civil rights leaders were trained. By the 1970s, she was involved in housing campaigns for the poor in New Jersey. She kept running into families with incarcerated loved ones. This led her to found Prison Watch. The letters that pour into her office are disturbing. Female prisoners routinely complain of being sexually abused by guards. One prisoner wrote to her office, "That was not part of my sentence to perform oral sex with officers." Other prisoners write on behalf of the mentally ill who have been left to deteriorate in the prison system. One California prisoner told of a mentally ill man spreading feces over himself and the guards, then dumping him into a scalding bath that took skin off 30% of his body. Kerness said the letters she receives from prisoners collectively present a litany of inhumane conditions, including cold, filth, callous medical care, extended isolation, often lasting years, use of devices of torture, harassment, brutality, and racism. Prisoners sent her drawings of 4- and 5-point restraints, restraint hoods, restraint belts, restraint beds, stun grenades, stun guns, stun belts, spit hoods, tethers, and waist and leg chains. But the worst torment, prisoners tell her, is the psychological pain caused by no-touch torture, which includes humiliation, sleep deprivation, sensory disorientation, extreme light or dark, extreme cold or heat, and extended solitary confinement. These techniques, she said, are consciously designed to carry out a systematic attack on all human stimuli. Sensory deprivation is used against Islamic militants, jailhouse lawyers, and the some 150 political prisoners, many part of radical black underground movements in the 1960s that advocated violence. A few, such as Leonard Peltier and Abu Jamal, are well known, but most have little public visibility. Among them are Sundiata Akoli, Mutulu Shakur, Imam Jamil al-Amin, known as H. Rap Brown when he was the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, in the 1960s, Jalil Bottom, Sakou Odinga, Abdul Majid, Tom Manning, and Bill Dunn. Those within the system who attempt to resist the abuse and mistreatment are dealt with severely. Prisoners in the overcrowded Southern Ohio Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison in Lucasville, Ohio, staged a revolt in 1993 after years of beatings, degrading rituals of public humiliation, and the alleged murders of prisoners by guards. Approximately 450 prisoners were able to unite antagonistic prison factions, including the Aryan Brotherhood and the Black Gangster Disciples, and hold out for 11 days by holding guards hostage. It was one of the longest prison rebellions in U.S. history. 9 prisoners and a guard were killed by the prisoners during the revolt. The state responded with characteristic fury. It singled out about 40 prisoners and eventually shipped them to Ohio State Penitentiary, OSP, a supermax facility outside Youngstown. There, prisoners are held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day in 7-by-11-foot cells. Prisoners at OSP almost never see the sun or have human contact. Some of those charged with participating in the uprising have been held in these punitive conditions at OSP or other facilities since the 1993 revolt. 5 prisoners involved in the uprising, Bomami Shakur, Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, Jason Robb, George Skatsis, and Namir Abdul Mateen, were charged with murder. They are being held in isolation on death row. Kerness said that the for-profit prison companies have created an entrepreneurial class like that of the Southern slaveholders, one dependent on the poor and on bodies of color as a source of income, and she described federal and state departments of corrections as a state of mind. This state of mind, she said in the interview, led to Abu Ghraib, Bagram, and Guantanamo, and what is going on in U.S. prisons right this moment. As long as profit remains an incentive to incarcerate human beings, and our corporate state abounds in superfluous labor, there is little chance that the prison system will be reformed. Our prisons serve the engine of corporate capitalism, transferring state money to private corporations. These corporations will continue to stymie rational prison reform because the system, however inhumane and unjust, feeds corporate bank accounts. At bottom, the problem is not race, although race plays a huge part in incarceration rates, nor is it ultimately poverty. It is the predatory nature of corporate capitalism itself, and until we slay the beast of corporate capitalism, until we wrest power back from corporations, until we build social institutions and a system of governance designed not to profit the few, but to foster the common good, our prison industry and the horror it perpetuates will only expand. African-American radicals were targeted first. Muslim radicals were targeted next, especially after the attacks of 9/11. Their stories differ little from those of Abu Jamal or Lutalo. Syed Fahad Hashmi, a U.S. citizen, is serving a 15-year sentence in Guantanamo-like conditions in the Supermax ADX Administrative Maximum Facility in Terre Haute, Indiana. He is isolated in a small cell for 22 to 23 hours a day. He has only extremely limited contact with his mother, father, and brother, often going weeks without any communication. He was charged by the government with two counts of providing and conspiring to provide material support to Al-Qaeda, and two counts of making and conspiring to make a contribution of goods or services to Al-Qaeda. He accepted a plea bargain on one count of conspiracy to provide material support to terrorism. If he had gone to trial, he would have faced the possibility of a 70-year sentence. The best the U.S. government could offer as evidence of Hashmi's crimes was that an acquaintance who stayed in his apartment with him in early 2004 while he was a graduate student in London, Junaid Babar, also an American citizen, had raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks in his luggage that were to be handed over to a member of Al-Qaeda in South Waziristan, Pakistan. Hashmi also allegedly permitted Babar to use his cell phone to contact others who were planning acts of terrorism. Babar, who was arrested in 2004 and pled guilty to five counts of material support for Al-Qaeda, also faced up to 70 years in prison. But he agreed to serve as a government witness against Hashmi, as well as in other terror trials, in exchange for a reduced sentence. I doubt that the government was overly concerned about a suitcase full of waterproof socks that were being taken to Pakistan. The reason Hashmi was targeted was because, like the Palestinian activist Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, he was fearless and zealous in his defense of those being bombed, shot, terrorized, and killed throughout the Muslim world. The government planned to introduce tapes of Hashmi's political talks while he was a student at Brooklyn College, during which time Hashmi was a member of the New York political group Al-Muhajirun. He made numerous provocative statements, including calling America the biggest terrorist in the world. But Al-Muhajirun is not defined by the government as a terrorist organization. Membership in the group is not illegal, and our complicity in massive acts of state terror is a historical fact. Hashmi had a right to express these sentiments. More important, he had a right to expect freedom from persecution and imprisonment because of his opinions. I spoke to Hashmi's father, Saeed Anwar Hashmi, in June 2011. The elder Hashmi came to the United States from Pakistan when Fahad was 3 and his other son, Faisal, was 4. He worked for more than 2 decades as an accountant for the city of New York. Anwar came, as most immigrants do, for his children. He believed in America, in its fairness, its chances for opportunity, its freedoms. And then it all crumbled when the state proved as capricious and cruel as the Pakistani dictatorship he had left behind. On the day of his son's arrest, he said, "My American dream became an American nightmare." Three law enforcement officials appeared at his home in Flushing, Queens on June 6, 2006, to inform him that his son, who had been in London completing a master's degree in international relations, had been arrested at Heathrow Airport on terrorism charges. Hashmi, after fighting the order for 11 months while in Belmarsh prison in London, was the first American citizen extradited under the post-9/11 laws. He was taken in May 2007 to the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Lower Manhattan and placed in solitary confinement. Like so many of those arrested during the Bush years, Hashmi was briefly a poster child in the War on Terror. His arrest was the top story on the CBS and NBC nightly news programs, which used graphics that read Terror Trail and Web of Terror. I came to this country from Pakistan nearly 30 years ago in 1982 with my wife and two young boys, his father said. Coming from a third world country, we were full of hope and looked towards America for liberty and opportunity. I had an American dream to work hard and give my sons good educations. I worked as an assistant accountant for the city of New York, 6 days a week, 9 hours a day, including overtime, to support my family and to send both my kids through college. We all became U.S. citizens, and my sons fulfilled my dreams by completing their undergraduate and postgraduate education. I was very proud of them. In high school and then as a student at Brooklyn College, Fahad became a political activist, concerned about the plight of Muslims around the world and the civil liberties of Muslims in America, he went on. Growing up here in America, Fahad did not fear expressing his views, but I was scared for him and urged him not to speak out. He would remind me that everything he did was under the law, but having grown up in a third world country, I had seen that it did not always work this way. And so I worried. He was monitored by law enforcement and quoted in Time magazine, but he kept speaking out. And then, with his arrest, my fears came true. Judge Loretta Preska, who would later oversee the case of the hacker Jeremy Hammond, denied Hashmi bail. His family and friends, who sat crowded together in the courtroom, listened in stunned silence. And then, after 5 months in jail, Hashmi, already isolated in solitary confinement, was suddenly put under special administrative measures. SAMs are the state's legal weapon of choice when it seeks to isolate and break prisoners. They were bequeathed to us by the Clinton administration, which justified SAMs as a way to prevent mafia and other gang leaders from ordering hits from inside prison. The use of SAMs expanded widely after the attacks of 2001. They are frequently used to isolate terrorism case detainees before trial. SAMs, which were renewed by Barack Obama, severely restrict a prisoner's communication with the outside world. They end calls, letters, and visits with anyone except attorneys and sharply limit contact with family members. Hashmi, once in this legal straitjacket, was not permitted to see much of the evidence against him under a law called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or CIPA. CIPA, begun under the Reagan administration, allows evidence in a trial to be classified and withheld from those being prosecuted. The weekly visits that Hashmi's family had made to the jail in Manhattan were canceled. A single family member was permitted to visit only once every 2 weeks, and on a number of occasions, the family member was inexplicably denied admittance. During the last 5 months of the trial, Hashmi's family was barred from visiting him. Anyone who has contact with a prisoner under SAMs is prohibited by law from disclosing any information learned from the detainee. This requirement, in a twist that Kafka would have relished, makes it illegal for those who have contact with an inmate under SAMs, including attorneys, to speak about his or her physical or psychological condition. The measures were imposed because of Hashmi's proclivity for violence, although he had not been charged with or convicted of committing an act of violence. Once the SAMs were imposed, he wrote us occasionally, one letter on no more than 3 pages at a time. But he was allowed no correspondence or contact with anyone else, his father said of his son. In addition, because of Fahad SAMs, we were not allowed to discuss anything we heard from him, including his health or any details of his detention or what he was experiencing with anyone else. It was like being suffocated. In a pretrial motion, Hashmi's lawyer presented the extensive medical and scholarly research that demonstrates the severe impact of solitary confinement on human beings, which often leaves them incapable of defending themselves during their trial. It did not sway the judge. Before ever being sentenced, Hashmi lived in a universe where he had no fresh air and was subjected to 23-hour lockdown and constant electronic surveillance, including when he showered or relieved himself. He was barred from group prayer. He exercised alone in a solitary cage. He was denied access to television or a radio. His newspapers were cut up by censors. And this was all before trial. These years have brought deep disillusionment for my family in the American justice system, Syed Anwar Hashmi said. Fahad was restricted in reviewing much of the evidence against him, and even his attorney could not discuss much of the evidence with him. Secret evidence is something we knew from back home. The judge accepted the prosecutor's motion to introduce Fahad's political activities and speeches into the trial to demonstrate his mindset. Where was the First Amendment to protect Fahad's speech? 2 days before the trial was set to begin, Judge Preska agreed to the prosecutor's motion to keep the jury anonymous and kept under extra security, even though this could have frightened the jury and affected how they viewed Fahad. On the day before trial, April 27, 2010, nearly 4 years since he had been arrested, I had just returned from dropping off clothes for Fahad to wear to court when I received a call from my attorney, his father said. The government had offered a deal to drop 3 of the 4 charges against Fahad if he accepted one charge which carried a 15-year sentence, and Fahad had agreed to this plea bargain. I was shocked by my son's decision on the eve of his trial, but after I thought more, I wondered how anyone could have decided differently in his situation. Fahad had been in solitary confinement under SAMS for nearly 3 years. The judge had in every instance sided with the government in pretrial motions. If convicted, Fahad faced a possible 70-year sentence. Fahad is serving his sentence at the federal supermax in Florence, Colorado. Hashmi's father added, "The U.S. government is concerned about human rights in China and Iran. I wonder about Fahad's rights and how they have been blatantly violated in this great land. It seems like innocent until proven guilty is only a saying. My son was treated as guilty until proven innocent." The Muslim community supported my son by offering prayers, particularly in the month of Ramadan, he said. But they were initially afraid to raise their voices against injustice. This reminds me of the fear the Chinese have under communist rule or Iranians under Ahmadinejad. As a citizen, I now have developed fear of my own government. For one charge for luggage, storing socks, ponchos, and raincoats in his apartment, he is serving a 15-year sentence in the harshest federal prison in the country, still in solitary confinement, still under SAMS, his father said. The cooperating witness in the case, the one who brought and delivered the luggage, is now free and able to enjoy his life and family. The despair and bewilderment of Hashmi's father are a reflection of the wider despair and bewilderment that have gripped the lives of many Muslims. There are many things I'd like to be able to say about the visit and my son's continuing detention, but because of Fahad Sams, I am forbidden, Hashmi's father said. Everything has changed for my family. Our first grandchild was born 19 days after Fahad's arrest, our second 2 years later. But now everything has a cloud over it. Graduations, birthdays, holidays, going to the store or the park or visiting family or running errands, and particularly the Eid day. In other words, we have lost our happiness. The extreme sensory deprivation used on Hashmi and other political prisoners is far more effective in breaking and disorienting detainees than physical abuse is. It is torture as science, the dark art of gradual psychological disintegration. By the time Hashmi was hauled into court, it was questionable whether he had the mental and psychological capability to defend himself or make rational judgments. He was told to stop speaking so quickly at his sentencing. He apologized to the court, saying he had spoken little during his years in isolation, and then burst into tears. This is what the system is designed to do. Constitutionally protected statements, beliefs, and associations are now a crime. Dissidents, even those who break no laws, can be stripped of their rights and imprisoned without due process. It is the legal equivalent of preemptive war. The state can detain and prosecute people not for what they have done, or even for what they are planning to do, but for holding religious or political beliefs that the state deems seditious. There will be more Hashemis. In 2006, the Justice Department, planning for future detentions, set up a segregated facility, the Communication Management Unit, at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. Nearly all the inmates transferred to Terre Haute are Muslims. A second facility has been set up at Marion, Illinois, where the inmates, again, are mostly Muslim, but also have included a sprinkling of animal rights and environmental activists, among them Daniel McGowan, who was charged with 2 counts of arson at logging operations in Oregon. His sentence was given terrorism enhancements under the Patriot Act. Amnesty International has called the Marion prison facility inhumane. All calls and mail are monitored in these 2 communication management units. Communication among prisoners is required to be only in English. These facilities replicate the conditions for most of those held at Guantanamo. In Franz Kafka's short story, Before the Law, a tireless supplicant spends his life praying for admittance into the courts of justice. He sits outside the law court for days, months, and years. He makes many attempts to be admitted. He sacrifices everything he owns to sway or bribe the stern doorkeeper. He ages, grows feeble, and finally childish. He is told as he nears death that the entrance was constructed solely for him, and it will now be closed. Justice has become as unattainable for Muslim activists and black radicals in the United States as it was for Kafka's frustrated petitioner. The draconian legal mechanisms that condemn African Americans and Muslim Americans who speak out publicly about the outrages we commit in our impoverished urban ghettos and the Middle East have left many, including Abu Jamal and Hashmi, wasting away in cages. The state has no intention of limiting its persecution to African Americans and Muslims. They were the first. We are next. Cecily McMillan sat in a plastic chair wearing a baggy, oversized gray prison jumpsuit, cheap brown plastic sandals, and horn-rimmed glasses. Other women, also dressed in prison-issued gray jumpsuits, sat nearby in the narrow, concrete-walled visitation room at Rikers Island in New York. Most were clutching their children, tears streaming down their faces. The children, bewildered, had their arms wrapped tightly around their mothers' necks. It looked like the disaster scene it was. "It's all out in the open here," said the 25-year-old graduate student at the New School of Social Research in New York City. "I spoke with her the day before she was sentenced in a New York criminal court on May 19, 2014, to 3 months in jail and 5 years probation. The cruelty of power can't hide like it does on the outside. You get America. Everything America has become, especially for poor people of color in prison. My lawyers think I will get 2 years. But 2 years is nothing compared to what these women, who never went to trial, never had the possibility of a trial without adequate legal representation, face. There are women in my dorm who, because they have such a poor command of English, do not even understand their charges. I spent a lot of time trying to explain the charges to them." McMillan endured the last criminal case originating from the Occupy Wall Street protest movement. It is also one of the most emblematic. The state, after the coordinated nationwide eradication of Occupy encampments, relentlessly used the courts to harass and neutralize Occupy activists, often handing out long probation terms that came with activists' forced acceptance of felony charges. A felony charge makes it harder to find employment and bars those with such convictions from serving on juries or working for law enforcement. Most important, the long probation terms effectively prohibit further activism by turning any arrest into a parole violation. McMillan, one of the few who refused to accept a plea deal and have a felony charge on her record, went to court. The Occupy Wall Street movement was not only about battling back against the rise of a corporate oligarchy, it was also about our right to peaceful protest. The police in cities across the country were deployed to short-circuit this right. I watched New York City police during the Occupy protests yank people from sidewalks into the street where they would be arrested. I saw police routinely shove protesters and beat them with batons. I saw activists slammed against police cars. I saw groups of protesters suddenly herded like sheep to be confined within police barricades. I saw and was caught up in mass arrests in which those around me were handcuffed and then thrown violently onto the sidewalk. The police often blasted pepper spray into faces from inches away, temporarily blinding the victims. This violence, carried out against nonviolent protesters, came amid draconian city ordinances that effectively outlawed protest and banned demonstrators from public spaces. It was buttressed by heavy police infiltration and surveillance of the movement. When the press or activists attempted to document the abuse by police, they often were assaulted or otherwise blocked from taking photographs or videos. The message the state delivered was clear: do not dissent. And the McMillan trial was part of the message. McMillan, who spent part of her childhood living in a trailer park in rural Texas, found herself with several hundred other activists at Zuccotti Park in Manhattan in March 2012 to mark the six-month anniversary of the start of Occupy Wall Street. The city, fearing the reestablishment of an encampment, deployed large numbers of police officers to clear the park just before midnight of March 17. The police, heavily shielded, stormed into the gathering in fast-moving lines. Activists, as Democracy Now! Reported, were shoved, hit, knocked to the ground, and cuffed. Some ran for safety. More than 100 people were arrested on the anniversary. After the violence, numerous activists would call the police aggression perhaps the worst experienced by the Occupy movement. In the mayhem, McMillan, whose bruises were photographed and subsequently displayed to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, was manhandled by a police officer later identified as Grantley Bovell. Bovell, who was in plain clothes and who, according to McMillan, did not identify himself as a policeman, allegedly came up from behind and grabbed McMillan's breast, a perverse form of assault by New York City police that other female activists also suffered during Occupy protests. McMillan's elbow made contact with his face, just below the eye, in what she says appeared to be a reaction to the grope. She says she has no memory of the incident. By the end of the confrontation, she was lying on the ground, bruised and convulsing after being beaten by the police. She was taken to a hospital emergency room where police handcuffed her to a bed. Had McMillan not been an Occupy activist, the trial that came out of this beating would have been about her receiving restitution from New York City for police abuse. Instead, she was charged with felony assault in the second degree and faced up to 7 years in prison. McMillan's journey from a rural Texas backwater to Rikers Island was a journey of political awakening. Her parents, divorced when she was small, had little money. At times, she lived with her mother, who worked in a Dillard's department store, as an accountant for a pool hall, and later, after earning a degree, as a registered nurse, doing weekly shifts of 60 to 70 hours in hospitals and nursing homes. There were also painful stretches of unemployment. Her mother was from Mexico, and she was circumspect about revealing her ethnicity in the deeply white conservative community, one in which blacks and other minorities were not welcome. She never taught her son and daughter Spanish. As a girl, McMillan saw her mother struggle with severe depression, and in one terrifying instance, she was taken to a hospital after she passed out from an overdose of prescription pills. For periods, McMillan, her brother, and her mother survived on welfare, and they moved often. She attended 13 schools, including 5 high schools. Her father worked at a Domino's pizza shop, striving in vain to become a manager. Racism was endemic in the area. There was a sign in the nearby town of Vidor, not far from the Louisiana state line, that read, "If you are dark, get out before dark." It had replaced an earlier sign that said, "Don't let the sun set on your ass, nigger." The families around the McMillans struggled with all the problems that come with poverty: alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic and sexual violence, and despair. Cecily's younger brother was serving a 7-year sentence for drug possession in Texas. "I grew up around the violence of poverty," she said. "It was normative." Her parents worked hard to fit into the culture of rural Texas. McMillan said she competed as a child in a beauty pageant called Tiny Miss Valentines of Texas. She was on a cheerleading team. She ran track. "My parents tried," McMillan said. "They wanted to give us everything. They wanted us to have a lifestyle we could be proud of. My parents, because we were at times poor, were ashamed of who we were. I asked my mother to buy Tommy Hilfiger clothes at the Salvation Army and cut off the insignias and sew them onto my old clothes. I was afraid of being made fun of at school. My mother got up at 5 in the morning before work and made us pigs in a blanket, putting the little sausages into croissants. She wanted my brother and myself to be proud of her. She really did a lot with so very little." McMillan spent most of her summers with her paternal grandmother in Atlanta. Those visits opened up another world for her. She attended a Spanish language camp. She went to blues and jazz festivals. She attended a theater summer camp called Seven Stages that focused on cultural and political perspectives. When she was a teenager, McMillan wrote collective theater pieces, including one in which she wore the American flag as a burqa and sang the Star Spangled Banner as a character dressed as Darth Vader walked onto the stage. "My father was horrified," she said. "He walked out of the theater." As a 13-year-old, she was in a play called I Hate Anne Frank. It was about American sensationalism, she said. It asked how the entire experience of the Holocaust could be turned for many people into a girl's positive narrative, a disgusting false optimism. It was not well received. In Atlanta, art, and especially theater, awakened her to the realities endured by others, from Muslims in the Middle East to the black underclass in the United States. And unlike in the Texas towns where she grew up, she made black friends in Atlanta. She began to wonder about the lives of the African Americans who lived near her in rural Texas. What was it like for them? How did they endure racism? Did black women suffer the way her mother suffered? She began to openly question and challenge the conventions and assumptions of the white community around her. She read extensively, falling in love with the work of Albert Camus. "I would miss bus stops because I would be reading The Stranger or The Plague," she said. "Existentialism to me was beautiful. It said, the world is shit. It said, this is the lot humanity is given. But human beings have to try their best. They swim and they swim and they swim against the waves until they can't swim any longer. You can choose to view these waves as personal attacks against you and give up, or you can swim. And Camus said, you should not sell out for a lifeboat. These forces are impersonal. They are structural. I learned from Camus how to live and how to die with dignity." She attended Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, through a partial scholarship and loans. As an undergraduate, she worked as a student teacher in inner-city schools in Chicago and joined the Young Democratic Socialists, the youth chapter of Democratic Socialists of America. In the fall of 2011, she enrolled at the New School for Social Research in New York City, where she planned to write a master's thesis on Jane Addams, Hull House, and the settlement movement. The Occupy Wall Street demonstrations began in the city 6 days after she arrived at the school. McMillan said that at first she was disappointed with the Occupy encampment in Zuccotti Park and felt that it lacked political maturity. She had participated in the political protests in Madison, Wisconsin in early 2011, and the solidarity of government workers, including police, that she saw there, deeply influenced her feelings about activism. She came away strongly committed to nonviolence. "Police officers sat down to occupy with us," she said of the protests in Madison. "It was unprecedented. We were with teachers, the fire department, police, and students. You walked around saying thank you to the police. You embraced police. But then I went to Occupy in New York and saw drum circles and people walking around naked. There was yoga. I thought, what is this? I thought for many protesters, this was just some social experiment they would go back to their academic institutions and write about. Where I come from, people are hungry. Women are getting raped. Fathers and stepfathers beat the shit out of children. People die. Some people would rather not live. At first, I looked at the occupiers and thought they were so bourgeois," she went on. "I thought they were trying to dress down their class by wearing all black. I was disgusted. But in the end, I was wrong. I wasn't meeting them where they were. These were kids, some of whom had been to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, who were the jewels of their family's legacy. They were doing something radical. They had never been given the opportunity to have their voices heard, to have their own agency. They weren't clowns, like I first thought. They were really brave. We learned to have conversations, and that was beautiful. And these people are my friends today. She joined Occupy Wall Street's Demands Working Group, which attempted to draw up a list of core demands that the movement could endorse. She continued with her academic work at the New School for Social Research and also worked part-time. McMillan was visiting her grandmother, who was terminally ill in Atlanta, in November 2011, when the police cleared out the Zuccotti Park encampment. When she returned to the New School, she took part in the occupation of school buildings, but some occupiers trashed the property, leading to a bitter disagreement between her and other activists. Radical elements in the movement who supported the property destruction held a shadow trial and condemned her as a bureaucratic provocateur. "I started putting together an affinity group after the New School occupation," she said. "I realized there was a serious problem between anarchists and socialists and democratic socialists. I wanted, like Bayard Rustin, to bring everyone together. I wanted to repair the fractured left. I wanted to build coalitions." Judge Ronald A. Zweibel was caustic and hostile to McMillan and her defense team when I attended the trial. Her defense lawyer said he barred video evidence that would have helped her case. He issued a gag order that forbade the defense lawyers, Martin Stoller and Rebecca Heinig, from communicating with the press. The jury was also barred from being made aware of the widespread and indiscriminate violence that took place in the park that night, much of it photographed. And the judge denied her bail. Bovell, the policeman who McMillan says beat her, had been investigated at least twice by the Internal Affairs Bureau of the New York City Police Department, according to the British newspaper The Guardian. Stoller's motion requesting access to Bovell's NYPD personnel file was rejected by Judge Zweibel, who said the attorney had failed to even establish that prior misconduct of any sort has been found or documented by the NYPD against Officer Bovell. In one of these cases, Bovell and his partner were sued for allegedly using an unmarked police car to strike a 17-year-old fleeing on a dirt bike. The teenager said his nose was broken, two teeth were knocked out, and his forehead was lacerated. The case was settled out of court. The officer was allegedly also captured on a video that appeared to show him kicking a suspect on the floor of a Bronx grocery, according to Stoller. Stoller also said he had seen documents that implicated Bovell in a ticket-fixing scandal in his Bronx precinct. Austin Guest, a 33-year-old graduate of Harvard University who was arrested at Zuccotti Park on the night McMillan was assaulted, was at the time suing Bovell for allegedly intentionally banging his head on the internal stairs of an MTA bus that took him and other activists in for processing. The judge ruled that Bovell's involvement in the cases stemming from the chasing of the youth on the dirt bike and the Guest arrest could not be presented as evidence in the McMillan case, according to The Guardian. The corporate state, unwilling to address the grievances and injustices endured by the underclass, is extremely nervous about the mass movements that have swept the country in recent years. And if protests erupt again, as I think they will, the state hopes it will have neutralized much of the potential leadership. Being an activist in a peaceful mass protest was the only real crime McMillan committed. "This was never about justice," she said, "just as it is not about justice for these other women. One mother was put in here for shoplifting after she lost her job and her house and needed to feed her children. There is another prisoner, a preschool teacher with a 1-year-old son she was breastfeeding, who let her cousin stay with her after her cousin was evicted. It turns out the cousin sold drugs. The cops found money, not drugs, that the cousin kept in the house and took the mother. They told her to leave her child with the neighbors. There is story after story in here like this. It wakes you up." McMillan, who was released on July 2, 2014, has since worked to organize outside support for those in Rikers who endure abuse and mistreatment. Her case stood in contrast with the blanket impunity given to the criminals of Wall Street. Some 8,000 nonviolent Occupy protesters were arrested across the nation. Not one banker or investor went to jail for causing the 2008 financial meltdown. The disparity of justice mirrored the disparity in incomes and the disparity in power. I am deeply committed to nonviolence, especially in the face of all the violence around me inside and outside this prison, McMillan said. I could not accept the plea deal. I had to fight back. That is why I am an activist. Being branded as someone who is violent was intolerable. The case galvanized many activists who saw in McMillan's persecution the persecution of movements across the globe struggling for nonviolent democratic change. McMillan was visited in Rikers by some of the Russian human rights campaigners from the dissident group Pussy Riot. Hundreds of people, including 9 of the 12 jurors and some New York City council members, urged Judge Zweibel to be lenient. An online petition signed by 195,949 people called on Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo to intervene on her behalf. I am very conscious of how privileged I am, especially in here, McMillan told me. When you are in prison, white privilege works against you. You tend to react when you come out of white privilege by saying, "You can't do that," when prison authorities force you to do something arbitrary and meaningless. But the poor understand the system. They know it is absurd, capricious, and senseless, that it is all about being forced to pay deference to power. If you react out of white privilege, it sets you apart. I have learned to respond as a collective, to speak to authority in a unified voice. And this has been good for me. I needed this. We can talk about movement theory all we want, she went on. We can read Michel Foucault or Pierre Bourdieu, but at a certain point, it becomes a game. You have to get out and live it. You have to actually build a movement. And if we don't get to work to build a movement now, there will be no one studying movement theory in a decade because there will be no movements. I can do this in prison. I can do this out of prison. It is all one struggle. When I saw McMillan, she was in Riker's Rose M. Singer Center with about 40 other women. They slept in rows of cots. Nearly all the women were poor mothers of color, most of them black, Hispanic, or Chinese. McMillan was giving lessons in English in exchange for lessons in Spanish. She had bonded with an African-American woman known as Fat Baby, who ogled her and told her she had nice legs. Fat Baby threw out a couple of lame pickup lines that, McMillan said, sounded as if she was a construction worker. I told her I would teach her some pickup lines that were a little more subtle. McMillan, who was required to have a prison activity, participated in the drug rehabilitation program, although she did not use drugs. She was critical of the instructor's feeding of positive and Christian thinking to the inmates, some of whom were Muslims. It is all about the power of positive thinking, about how they made mistakes and bad choices in life, and now they can correct those mistakes by taking another road, a Christian road to a new life, she said. This focus on happy thoughts pervades the prison. There is little analysis of the structural causes for poverty and oppression. It is as if it was all about decisions we made, not that were made for us. And this is how those in power want it. This kind of thinking induces passivity. McMillan was receiving dozens of letters daily at Rikers, but during the week before my visit, she was told every day that she had none. She suspected the prison had cut off the flow of mail to her. My pens and paper were confiscated during the 2-hour process it took to enter Rikers Island. I had to reconstruct the notes from our conversation, which lasted an hour and a half. The entry process is normal for visitors, who on weekends stand in long lines in metal chutes outside the prison. My body was searched and my clothing was minutely inspected for contraband. I had to go through 2 metal detectors. It is hard to read. It is hard to write, she went on. There is constant movement and constant noise. McMillan had just finished writing a message to supporters who planned to rally in her support the afternoon before her sentencing. She told them, "Oppression is rampant. Take a moment to try and really see, hear, feel the suffering of the many around you. Now imagine the power of your collective love ethic to stand against it. Only through the pervasive spread of such a love ethic by the many for the many, not just the privileged few, will we finally have ourselves a movement." McMillan took comfort from her supporters and her family and from those of her heroes who endured prison for a just cause. She had read and reread the speech the socialist Eugene V. Debs made to a federal court in Cleveland before he went to prison for opposing the draft in World War I. His words, she said, had become her own. "Your Honor, years ago I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth," Debs said. "I said it then, as I say it now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it, and while there is a criminal element, I am of it, and while there is a soul in prison, I am not free."